Welcome to The Afterglow. The Afterglow podcast gives women, we're talking to you, the permission and tools to live life according to your own rules.
Yes, this is a platform to educate and empower women identifying humans through intriguing conversations with courageous Canadian women who are breaking down limiting beliefs and outdated rules. These women have done it, are doing it, or can provide tools for you to do the same.
We are Julie Watson
and Liz Doyle-Hermer.
And we started Afterglow, our yoga studio, after years of staying home to raise kids. Now, as podcasters, we want to help others do the same. Step into your own power. It's time to shake things up and get real about who you are and what you want.
The Afterglow is your next act. It's what came after you did what you were told and instead decided to do what was in your heart. It's how you have reinvented yourself. It's your vision for the next 40 to 50 years. It's when you took your power back.
Welcome to The Afterglow. We are so excited about today's guest. Michelle Mellis is on the show today. She was born in Michigan and raised by an artist father obsessed with Bob Dylan. I really love this bio, who taught her the words military industrial complex at the age of four, and a mother who captured her attention with vivid, sometimes terrifying fairy tales. Raised without TV, Michelle was obviously bound to become a storyteller for TV. Based in Toronto now, she is an award-winning documentary filmmaker and story editor whose first feature-length documentary film, which we will talk about, Drunk on Too Much Life, is challenging the way we perceive, understand, and treat serious mental illness. She holds an MFA in documentary media from Toronto Metropolitan University. She is also a big part of our Afterglow community. In fact, she has used her skills to create and record our own promo videos that you can see on our website. And we love and cherish you, Michelle. And we're so happy to have you here today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be on this, on your podcast.
Michelle, raised without TV. What was that about?
Well, my parents were hippies and we immigrated to Canada, you know, during Trudeau Senior's years. And my father we just didn't have a TV. And so whenever it was very exciting when I went babysitting or when I went to friends' houses and they had actual color TV or a TV in general. So we learned how to... But it was a good thing because in a way, you learn to be really creative and you like, it's kind of the Waldorf style of parenting, you know, where you're just like lots of crafts and making art and that kind of thing. Playing outside. I mean, remember those? People don't play outside, our kids. I mean, we were free range kids. So.
Yeah. Do you think that is what like brought you into becoming so creative and then moving into this path of work? Because no TV to now being in like film and television, there feels like there's kind of like this disconnect. How did you jump? What was the path that you took?
I love writing. I love stories. And so I was hired in TV to tell, at first as a researcher, and then I went quickly into storytelling. And so it was very fun. It's a very fun job to create, you know, TV in this case, it was short documentaries for a show called Sex TV, which was around in Canada, believe it or not, for 10 years. And it was regular broadcast television. And it was Cynthia Lois. We hired Cynthia. She was our intern back in the day, believe it or not. And then we all kind of grew up together, really. And it was a really fun show to explore like sexuality and gender in a really open-minded way. Like we just completely opened our minds and we were given free range to do whatever stories we wanted to do and put it on broadcast. And at that time it was national. And it's long story short, like, you know, it went through like CTV and Bell Media. I don't want to get into too many political details, but they shut the show down because the organization became more conservative.
That's too bad. That's too bad, Michelle. You know, and so you're, I kind of, whenever my child is watching too much YouTube or on her phone too much, in my mind, I'm like, well, maybe she'll make something of it. She'll become, you know, a TV producer or a film producer. And you're just throwing that argument out the window because it's obviously lack of TV that leads to that, not overindulgence in TV. But you went back to school recently. Is that right? Or am I wrong? You went back to school recently.
Yeah, I went back. It was kind of like a bucket list kind of thing where I wanted to go back and get my master's. It had always been kind of brewing there. And I thought, you know, as I got older, okay, I might as well. Although I hear people go, you know, there was a 70-year-old in our cohort, not in our amazing cohort, but the year before. Like, so it's never too late to go back to school. But it was kind of funny because, you know, you feel like a kid again with your backpack. Yeah. Going to the library, and it felt really fun to go back to school.
And it was film. It was film you studied, film TV production.
Documentary.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. And that's where so my husband and I started Drunk on Too Much Life in 2017. And then I finished it for my MFA at TMU, Toronto Metropolitan University.
So do you want to tell us a little bit about like the creation of Drunk on Too Much Life? Like, where did it come from? Where did the idea come from? And then tell us what it's about. I mean, Liz and I know what it's about, but we want our listeners to hear just about it's a very profound documentary.
Thank you. We started the film in 2017. Our daughter, Karina became really unwell at 21 and went into, like, I didn't even know the terminology, but she went into what's called psychosis, which is like this almost like this extreme state where you're maybe seeing things or hearing voices, and we didn't really know what that was. And so we kind of landed in the psychiatric system. And at first we kind of completely went into the model, and we thought, you know, we thought that psychiatry, and I'm not going to denigrate psychiatry because there are incredible psychiatrists out there, but we thought psychiatry had come a lot farther than it had. Mm. And so the medications that Karina was given, it was like from some of the 50s and 60s still. And there wasn't, anyway, so it was all about medication. It became all about, you know, if she somehow took all her medication, we would find, you know, there would be some sort of healing that would take place. And we just didn't find that. So she went into like episode after episode, and we were, the only thing we were being offered was medication after medication. And so we just grabbed, because we're filmmakers and storytellers, and the camera is like a way for us, like, first of all, the camera itself is a therapeutic device. Like, if you put a camera in a room, people open up. It's also a way to tell a story to your own story. So it's an empowering device. And so we just kind of grabbed our cameras and started to question the whole system in a way. It was like, but a process, a journey with our daughter, like, how can we start to expand the limited narrative of, you know, that it's just problematic brain chemistry or brain pathology, and that there's a quick fix with the medication. You know, we wanted to say, well, things are much more complex in a way. And so we started the film as, and we didn't obsessively film our family at all. It was like, you know, we were very concerned with the ethics of the film. So we were only going to shoot when Karina was well, or when any of the participants in the film were well and lucid. So there was a lot of consent. And then we just, but our question was like, you know, how do we come to understand kind of mental illness when the mental health system isn't working, essentially? You know, it was like, how can we expand the limited notion of recovery and healing? So, for example, and I know I'm talking long, but our narrative in our culture is like, blame the individual brain chemistry, instead of looking at things in more complex ways, that it's how we how we are involved with our families, how we are involved with our community and our political and economic and social systems, that everything's interconnected. It's not simply just your problematic brain chemistry. It's how these all these dynamics come to play in this really complex way. And so we start to go on this journey of interviewing people. Karina would interview people and we were filming this and she would learn and we would learn as a family. And do you want
how to did go? You, yeah. How did you, yeah, no, I'm curious about how you knew this model of the psychiatric system wasn't working. Right. So sometimes you go in and you're in the system and then you start getting the medication and then it works for the person or you think it works. And right. I mean, that's the thing is maybe it's working, but it's actually not working. And we don't really know because it's just like, just take the medication. It'll be fine. Like, how did you know that it wasn't working for you, for Karina?
Yeah. Well, we started to feel like already early on that some of this might have had to do with trauma. But we didn't have a psychiatrist tell us that at that time. And so it wasn't until literally Karina had been in and out of the system for a long time, like 5 years already. And on our journey of recovery and questioning and all of us on camera, we met Gabor Mate, Dr. Gabor Mate. And we, you know, we sat in his kitchen for a one-on-one kind of therapy session. We didn't know how intense it would be. I was supposed to be second camera. And, you know, he said, I'll be very direct. And we were like, okay, sure, bring it on. But we had no idea what that really meant. And we were just, he was so intense. And he really kind of he dove right into the whole origin of where this comes from, which is childhood trauma. And we don't want to, I don't want to blame everything on childhood trauma. I think his, like, he also has his like kind of agenda, but I do think that that was a huge factor and that we hadn't really, no other doctor had talked to us about that, which was insane. So this whole time, which was insane here, but it, you know, for 5 years for a doctor just to be giving medication and not really talking about, well, let's talk about the origin of these things or how these come. And the other issue was Galbert brought up was how extremely sensitive Karina is. And that was another thing that the Karina is the kind of kid, and we wish we had known this as parents, that she is like extremely sensitive. Like so sensitive, and that, you know, what she went through, what people call childhood trauma with her was, you know, another kid, like my niece would have been fine, like whatever, like she's just, like tougher, right? In a way, I don't want to say tougher isn't a good thing, but, and then we started connecting all of that too with like sensitivity has to do with creativity and all the other things that come with sometimes madness in a way, like think of all the artists but we didn't want to frame the we didn't want to say, oh, on the one hand, it's like the psychiatric model. And on the other hand, it's the mad genius creative artist. It's complicated. And so that was why we kind of showed all these different parts of the way to understand these things, these experiences.
Yeah. I love the description of the movie. The documentary Drunk on Too Much Life, and there's just a small section I'll read, but on the journey, the family begins to question the widespread idea that mental illness should be understood in purely biological terms and learns the myriad ways that madness has meaning. And I'm curious about the madness has meaning part. There's in what you just said, I'm understanding there's a gift in the sensitivity, right? What's the gift that you see in Karina in the sensitivity?
Yeah, so we on our journey, we met this guy named Sasha DeBruhl, who is a kind of a American activist and clinician. And he, you know, he talks a lot about the role of language in a way and stories and how we understand these experiences. And so he said, you know, rather than seeing ourselves as diseased or disordered, let's see ourselves as having dangerous gifts like the wings of Icarus. And so, yeah, it can be a bit dangerous if you fly too close to the sun, but it can be also really creative. And so he also says things like, you know, I don't take psych drugs to manage my mental illness. I take them to control my superpower. So it's almost like seeing things like, oh, it's not your problematic, you know, you're not completely, you're not ill, you know,
you're not broken. Like, you're not broken is what I hear. Yeah.
You're not broken, but these can be beautiful gifts if they're cultivated and if the child or person is protected and given all these resources that they need, which is the problem because our society doesn't do that. Right. So we tend to kick people to the, like I said in the film, it's like either in Toronto and in the United States, certainly it's like the home, the hospital, or the streets. Like we don't have, you know, we're getting into the political dimension of this, but we don't have the services to support people to bring out their dangerous gifts, like, or their gifts in a way. Like we,
Loss given the problems in our world, right? That feels like a loss that we're not accessing those dangerous things.
That's one thing that really came out in the film was like, if we lived in a culture that supported, you know, children that are really sensitive or people that are really sensitive, these expressions come out beautifully, but instead they mutate in a way and they're stuck in mental institutions sometimes because we're not supporting them and bringing out their gifts.
Mm-hmm. I feel that strongly that the systems are not designed for anybody. And we know this in school systems. We know this in the education system. They're not designed for any neurodiversities, anybody who's a little bit different. I mean, I have kids with ADHD and, you know, you look at how they're treated in the school and they're treated with like special treatment for their plan because they're different. And, you know, I love that all these things are superpowers. I love thinking of those things as, you know, like, how can we change the system to create a better environment for everyone so that we can all excel or all tap into those superpowers? I think that's amazing. And I know that you are very, you know, political and social activists in this. And it's even throughout, you know, weaved throughout the film. But I just wanted to go back to the whole trauma aspect for a quick second, because I know that Gabor Maté talks about it being trauma, not being what happened to you, but it's what happens inside of you when something happens to you, which really ties into the whole sensitivity thing, right? Like, if you are sensitive and your neighbor is not, or your best friend is not, this might not, you know, make them feel a certain way. Like I remember being a little kid and being so sensitive and being like in an elevator one time and the elevator door closed on somebody's arm and I just jumped and whatever. And the woman was like, oh, I'm okay. But that's still a memory in me because it was so traumatizing to my little self at the time. Somebody else might have just been in the elevator, like whatever, on their iPhone, like not paying attention. And so I want to talk about what are the methods that you did learn through this experience with Gabor Maté, or that you are doing with other doctors or specialists, that are methods of treatment that you are using now?
Right. Well, I think he made us really aware that, like he says in the film, like to Karina, what if your so-called delusions are true? Like he's like, and so we were like, what does that mean? And he said, like, what that means is like true to her emotional reality. So she take your emotional reality is like as a child. So we learned through the filmmaking that she was really bullied as a child. And again, another kid would have been much I grew up in the 70s. So imagine I was like, everybody was bullied. So we were, as parents too, we were a little bit like, oh, you know, not that we were dismissing it. Like first of all, she didn't really tell us the extent of her bullying, but also I think Pedro and I, my husband and I, because we grew up in the 70s, where it was like, really, you had to be tough. We were just thought that was probably a natural part of being a child. So we didn't really know also the extent of it. So Gabor kind of really made us understand, like, in a very direct way how that impacted Karina. And like the fact that maybe Pedro and I weren't as available as parents, and we learned this from our parents and they learned it from their parents, and we're all learning. And it wasn't like he wasn't blaming us. And we don't want to get into that. The parents are the fault of all of this, because that's how it used to be viewed. And we don't want to move. We don't want to move into that direction, but we've gone way too far in the direction of it's only a biochemical matter. And we don't look at how all of these things from the child, their childhood experiences affects the child. And like you said, Julie, but your sensitivity, right? So it's, I think we have to look at things just in a more complex way. Like ADHD, I remember asking the psychiatrist about ADHD in children, because they were throwing so many kids were being diagnosed with and put on Ritalin. And he was like, I said, well, if this is just a natural part of the human brain, like, why are we medicating so much? And he said, well, basically to fit into the world. Like, that's what it's, so it's like, oh, let's change the kid's brain to fit into the world, our like very aggressive, capitalistic world. And so basically that's what you're kind of doing, is creating a brain that, or we're giving drugs to our kids so that they can fit into our, you know, our, the way our world is, which is dysfunctional. And that's why Gabor says in his book, it's like healing out of the, oh no, I'm blanking on that. What his book's called again? What's it called? The Myth of Normal Healing Something in a Toxic Culture. Mm-hmm. I better get that right. What is it? You guys cut this part.
It is the myth of
trauma, illness. Yeah, the myth of normal trauma, illness, and healing in a toxic culture.
That's right. So that's an important, the toxic culture is a part of, we have to start talking about that. Yeah, like we're giving all our these kids medications to fit into our toxic culture.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, what I heard in what you said is that Gabor really educated you on the impact of trauma, right? And that early adversity delivered at a young age can have a traumatic imprint, even more so for people that are sensitive. And I'm curious, did you learn any ways in which you can work through the trauma that have been helpful?
That's a really, you know, we talked, because we did a Mad in America screening yesterday across the United States and Canada and Europe, and people were asking about that a lot. And Karina was talking about like really like the benefits of talk therapy and like doing work, like just she's done so much work on herself, and understanding where it's coming from has really helped. Another, in terms of trauma in mental illness, so to speak, you know, when it comes out like in a crazy way, like mania, or you know, like these extreme experiences, sleep is a huge factor. Like looking at things like in terms, like you can't dissociate all of these experiences from looking at things in terms of holistic health, right? Like eating well, sleeping well, you know, understanding your brain therapy, and you know, like exercise, yoga, all these grounding things. These are all hugely important in getting in touch with your body too. So we didn't put this in the film, but Gabor did a lot of work with Karina on body work, like just where is this located in your body? Like this is, you know, so that kind of work with people is excellent as well. So getting, and I do, you know, trauma means, the Greek word for trauma means wound, right? That's the actual literal word. And wounds can heal, right? So, and one of the things that trauma causes a disconnection. And Gabor says this in the film, like it's a disconnection. And so the thing that heals trauma as well is connection. Because the most extreme parts of mental illness is because of a loss of connection with people, a loss of connection with your community, a loss of connection with your whatever, families, loved ones. People are forgotten about, they're ignored, they're kicked to the curb. And so what, you know, what heals people and heals trauma is connection.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Gabor also talks a lot about, you know, the psychedelic potential for healing. And so I'm curious as to if you guys have delved into that route and if that's helped Karina at all and how she feels about that.
Yeah, that's not, I think that's more for people that don't have, like, have a struggle with, like, kind of psychosis, because she's mm-hmm. already out there. Like, it's like, mm-hmm. my dad's an artist, mm-hmm. and he smokes a bit of pot, and he's on another planet. It's like, mm-hmm. Dad, you're acting like you're on acid. Like, he like, little, because he's so creative and in touch. Mm-hmm. He's already there.
Right.
So, you know, we don't have to, like, the Karina is the same way. So I think, you know, people that are more probably more grounded and, you know, can use psychedelic therapy, but not for people that have more extreme, you know, mental illness like bipolar or schizophrenia.
I think that that's good to know. Like, it's good to note, right? Because it's such a popular thing right now mm-hmm. out there. Do you think that the stigma obviously has an effect, the stigma of mental health issues has an effect, but do you think that the acceptance that you guys have shown that, you know, Karina has probably had to evolve to has really helped in this process? Because I think that's, like you said, the disconnect and not connecting, feeling connected, feeling loved yeah. through your disorders and accepting that this is a part of who you are. Is that, does that play a role in the healing?
Yeah, 100%. Like you, like, I think what happens with diagnoses and stigma, right, is that we otherize and we want to bring this back to this is a human condition. Like, all, if you think about a lot of all mental illnesses, like, who hasn't, like, suffered with a bit of OCD, for example? I know I have. I'm sure everybody has. Like, these are all conditions or anxiety or depression or, you know, they're natural parts of the human experience. So it's bringing it back to the humanity and that we're not, it's not about so much, you know, like stigmatizing and, you know, otherizing. And I think that's what the problem is sometimes with, say, diagnoses. Like I always say, you know, when we call somebody a schizophrenic or he's bipolar, and we don't say, you know, with cancer, you know, he's cancer. Or he, you know, like all of a sudden that person has become completely defined by their diagnosis, mm. you know, like, or he's an ADHD, you know, we don't say that even with ADHD, but we do have a tendency to do that with more extreme mental illness. So when people in the film too, Karina meets mad activists along the way, and she talks to, it's this, a mad activist named Kevin Healy, who has this event in Toronto called Mad Acts. And literally it's just a performance night where people can just be human and diagnostic labels are left at the door and they're just allowed to express themselves and express their humanity. Cause the like he says in the film, you know, the language is so important, like how we define these things and how we categorize. And also people are afraid because of horror. So if you think about it, like horror films have done a horrible number because a lot of like, I think we think of these, we get terrified because it's like, oh, and then the media is horrible with portraying these, all of these experiences.
How were you able to engage Karina in this? You know, I think of my own teenage children, getting them to have dinner with me is a challenge. How were you able to engage her in this and something so personal, to have her be open to this? How did you do that?
Well, we started kind of the film together in a way, but then yeah, she was sometimes it would be like, ah, oh, like I actually, we didn't shoot too much with her, like, because we were aware of, like, we didn't want to bug her too much. And when we did get those interviews with her, she was on, like, very wanting to be on camera. So we only, yeah. She's also grown up with the camera because Peter mm-hmm. and I have been, since she was born, we've been like in the media. So she's kind of, we've had her in stories, like in television, like we've from the very beginning. So the kids have been used to parents that are, are, you know, obsessed with cameras.
She's brave. She's brave, and obviously she trusts. You have trust in your relationship there.
Yeah, right? And she saw the film and was we wouldn't put it out in the world unless she was okay with it. And you know, we also, like, it's a hero's journey, the film, in a way. And Gabor is like the height of the, you know, the hero's journey. You know what that, you know, that mythology where it's, yeah. I think Joseph Campbell, yeah. And like all stories go on that journey. And we kind of did that journey as well, where the height of the journey actually was meeting Gabor. And that was like, you know, that was really difficult for our family because it was very painful. Because we were like, okay, how have we as parents, how have we been involved? Like, I mean, it comes out in the film too that, you know, Pedro and I had a really difficult time in our marriage, and we fought, you know, I don't think we were out of control, but we, because of Karina being so sensitive, she internalized all of that. Mm-hmm. And she took the responsibility of being the parent. I think that's what happens sometimes. And you know, divorces too, where it's like all of a sudden, it depends on the age. Like the worst age actually is about 8, which is what Karina was at, just going into puberty. So it's very, that was really hard. And we knew when she developed, when she started to develop, you know, go into these more extreme states, we had a feeling like, oh shit, some of this is coming out from we fought back then at when she was 8. Mm-hmm. And talk about feeling guilty, you're like, oh my god, like if I had no idea, right? But
yeah, how is that for you as a mother, right? Like, you know, we're all mothers here, so to know how you feel about your child first of all, but also the stress that is on you at all times when your child is struggling, how did you manage for yourself? How did you take care of yourself? How did you personally get through this time as well?
Oh, that's a really hard, it's, you know, parents have asked us that question a lot. And I think it was really hard. Like, I think, cause you know, that whole metaphor of putting on your own oxygen mask before you put it on your child, that's really hard as a mother, as you know, cause you're like, I want to give my oxygen mask to my kid. Mm-hmm. But I just kept thinking about that metaphor. And my dad helped me a lot too. And he would say, you know, you have to take care of yourself. And I think, you know, we learned the hard way. And I think Pedro didn't take care of himself. Like we have another son who didn't want to be in the film. So he's like, he was, you know, we had another son and we had cats and we had, you know, I had other responsibilities. So we couldn't be at the hospital all the time, or I couldn't be. But Pedro would be at the hospital all the time. We kept saying, you know, you can't be there all the time. You can't, this is going to affect you. And he got cancer. And mm-hmm. we don't, you know, we're not blaming. We're just saying that if you don't take care of yourself, definitely you can get sick yourself. Mm-hmm. And then what do you do with that, right? Once you're sick, mm-hmm. it's really hard. So it's very, very important to take care of yourself.
I'm sorry to hear that, Michelle. Yeah. It's a lot of challenges, right? Physical, mental. Wait, so, you know, going forward or even today, how do you support yourself, your self-care practices? What is that? What does that look like for you?
Well, that's where you guys come in. but it's true. Like, you know, I find yoga extremely helpful. It's just in terms of grounding and breathing and exercise in general, that to me is a real gift. And also I think, you know, just sleeping is really important. Like, I'm going to reinforce that. That's a thing that's come up over and over again mm-hmm. with all mental health, is the importance of sleep. Something that we, you know, with the Donald Trump saying they only need 4 hours of sleep, and somehow we're made to feel guilty for sleeping right. in our world. So like the importance of sleep, the importance of things like yoga. In the movie, we have Qigong, which is Karina was doing Qigong. The first thing that on our path was doing something like Qigong. nutrition and exercise and, you know, all of those things. It's hard to remember those things though when you're
For sure, those go out the window in crisis.
Yeah. For us, you know, even the littlest things were like, you know what, let's just go to the coffee shop and have like a double mocha, blah, blah, blah. And just like really those little treats are really important.
When it's like little moments of joy, right? When you can actually get into the moments of joy and the gratitude, then it will definitely take you away from the stress and the pain of what you're experiencing and the fear. I mean, I can imagine that. Through all of it, I mean, I know from my own personal experience with my own kids too, like there's a lot of fear involved in, and you mentioned it before, like the crazy, right? There's so much fear in that. And that's the last thing you want for your kids. So are you still afraid or do you feel like you've moved into acceptance as well?
Afraid of the crazy or like I think the fear is gone because like, I think, you know, when Pedro at first, when this first happened to us, like the only reference we had was horror films. It's true. It's like the most extreme crazy. And then, you know, now we're like, oh, okay, that's one message I really want to impart is that when somebody's struggling like that, we have to all remember that person is in pain, right? A person's struggling is in pain, and we as human beings it's our responsibility to help them, right? It's not to be scared of them. They're actually in pain. So I think that's what happens is people get freaked out and they forget the person's humanity. So I think
Michelle, our definition of the afterglow is that it's what you want to pursue when you listen to your heart and 100% believe in yourself. And I'm curious, what's your afterglow or what's next for you?
Well, when you say that, I think about being authentic, and you guys have talked about that too, like about the importance of like kind of an authenticity. So I think I'm not afraid to be authentic anymore. Because I think our whole world, we're always made to feel like, oh, you have to act a certain way or you have to be, you know, all this presentation, and that we are learning, we all know is bullshit. And so what really counts is like, you know, love and compassion and kindness. And so moving forward as much as you can, of course, everybody struggles, but it's always trying to remind yourself of that every day.
I mean, I think you completely demonstrate that in just obviously being authentic about what's happened in your world and your life and your family. But I can attest to seeing you coming into the studio and you are truly like an authentic energy from, I think, the moment that I met you. So you're already living your afterglow, really. I want to know what advice or what you might want to offer other mothers, other family members who might be experiencing, you know, their kids or even themselves who are struggling with their mental health. Like, do you have any, I know you're not the doctor, but any steps or any processes that you would recommend, obviously sleep, but for others going through experiences such as yours?
Yeah. We talked about this yesterday too. I think, you know, there's a movement called the peer support movement. And so these are peer support workers, peer supporters, I think some people call them. And they're basically people with lived experience that have come, you know, that are kind of working one-to-one with somebody that's struggling. And in our experience, that was hugely important for Karina's recovery. It's like, and Gabor talks about that too, like the role of how important peer support workers are in recovery because they've been there. Mm-hmm. Even for example, the other day, Karina was struggling and we were like worried, and we called Amanda, we called her cousin, who's also a peer support worker. And Amanda just shared her experiences with Karina, and within minutes, it was like everything was okay again. It was like, it's this idea that friends make the best medicine. Mm. And so, but people that are peer support workers are also trained. And so they've had lived experience. So I really, really encourage parents to check, you know, those avenues out with peer support workers. There's a place called Stella's Place which is in the film. And it's an incredible place. It was also started by another mother who was looking for a path to recovery for her daughter, Stella. Mm-hmm. And it's for ages 16 to 29. And it's peer based, peer centered. The peer support workers hire everybody, and there's programs, there's employment programs, there's like art programs. You can just go to there for a coffee. They have all sorts of activities. And it's the model, I think, for kids that are struggling. If your kid is struggling, send them to Stella's Place, because you can meet other people that are struggling, and they have support systems in place. It's exactly what I wanted for other. I believe a place like Stella's Place should be in every single neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I've never even heard of that. Yeah.
And
yeah,
is it Stella's free? Place. Is it free to attend? Free. Is it free to go and get the support?
It's free.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And it's private, because like, this is the thing about, like, I'm like, this should be offered in the public system, but we don't have that. So she started this. This is a mother who started fundraising and did Stella's Place. And it's one of the only places, I think, in the world. And so we need those. And she's been asked all over, like, we need these kinds of models where, you know, people can go and take yoga class and do all sorts of things, and all free, and meet other kids their age. Because like she says in this, Donna Green is the mother who started it, and she says in the film, like, you know, 16 to 29 is that transitioning age, like, mm-hmm. where you're going from a child to an adult. And so it's such an important age, right? And so how to, you know, and the importance of connection, so that they don't feel alone, you know, like, honestly, if my child was struggling, I would bring them to Stella's Place and the peer support movement there. So, and activities, art, music.
Creative expression, connection and creative expression. Those are powerful tips, Michelle. And, you know, in that peer support model, I'm seeing the benefit to the individual getting the peer support, but also for the peer who's giving the support, how meaningful and purposeful it must feel, right? To be supporting someone who was once where you were. And Karina's doing, your daughter's doing peer support work now.
Yeah, in the film, she was meeting with Donna Green, and then she wanted to be a peer support worker. And now she's trained, a lot of training involved too. And they're kind of, they're counselors in a way, but they're on the same level. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's always a power differential with psychiatry or counseling, whereas peer support workers are on the same level. And so it's a different model.
I love that. I think that's a beautiful model. Where did the title come from? Drunk on Too Much Life?
So that was Karina when she was like 6 years old. She actually came up with, she thought that she described being crazy as being drunk on too much life. And we just thought that was such a beautiful way to describe what crazy is, because it is being drunk on too much life. It's so much life. It's like this exuberance, but sometimes that can be dangerous, right? It's like, how do we, and I mean, just as a metaphor, like, because Pedro, in the film, you'll see it, Pedro got cancer, and this is a whole other, I'll do a couple minute story here, but first of all, cancer is like drunk on too much life in a way. Like, it's also, it can get out of control, right? So we, at one point, we were going to kind of do those two analogies, but we didn't. Like, so just as a, I don't know, this is not a good way to end the story, but anyway, when Karina was, and this is one of the reasons we started the film too, is that she was in one of these extreme states, and she saw Pedro was really sick and coughing a lot. And I wasn't worried about him because he's healthy and he was riding his bike every day. And then, but she, in one of her extreme states, saw two dark spirits coming out of his lungs. And then and 3 weeks later, they found two tumors in his lungs.
Gosh.
So she was able to see that, in a different way. And so that's what, I mean, Gabor says, sensitive, even somewhat psychic kids. Mm-hmm. Like, so she, and it's just, and it's that kind of spectrum of, mm-hmm. Yeah. Behavior. That was like really not the greatest ending, but
no, it sounds powerful to me. Michelle, that sounds powerful to me. It really does. You know, I think mm-hmm. there's things we don't understand in this world, and that you're talking about that sensitivity, right? It's extra sensory, that ability she has, right? And how that could, I imagine, feel overwhelming at times. Yeah. But obviously there's a gift in that. Too.
Exactly. And that's the problem, is I think when you're that sensitive and you can see things like that, then imagine this world, right? How hard that would be.
Yeah, for sure. So Drunk on Too Much Life will be broadcast on TVO March 14th at 9 p.m. EST. Yeah. And we're also
on Canopy streaming platform, which you just need a free library card. And for those educators and clinicians out there, it's available for education licensing through New Day Films. And so if you, New Day Films, Drunk on Too Much Life, and it will eventually land online as well. I'll just put it up for people to, on like Apple TV or something like that, but not yet.
And Drunk on Too Much Life is literally drunkontoomuchlife.com and New Day Films.
That's right. Oh, yeah. www.drunkontoomuchlife. A lot of people think it's too much love, but it's drunkontoomuchlife.com.
Yeah, I love that title. And I love just how open you have been, obviously, in doing the film, but even in the conversation about it, you know, going there and talking about you know, what your family has experienced. But obviously you've generated a lot of new knowledge along the way and information that is really important to be out there. So thank you so much for coming on today and sharing all of that with us, your authenticity and your vulnerability. And we so appreciate you, Michelle.
I appreciate you too. Thank you so much for providing a beautiful little community and a place to ground myself and do yoga. Thank you both.
That's a wrap for this episode of The Afterglow. Yet another courageous Canadian sharing her vision.
Do us a favor and lift a sister up by sharing this podcast with others who want to find their afterglow. And let us know. What do you want to hear about? Who do you want to hear from? And what is your afterglow? Slide on into our DMs at The Afterglow Podcast Official and leave us a message.
Did you love this podcast? Be sure to like and rate us on Spotify and iTunes and wherever you tune in. Until next time.